All right, welcome to Season 2, Episode 25, which is also Episode 57 of the Retro Game Club podcast. With me is someone that I found within the Nintendo Giga Leak, Hugh.
Yeah, yep. There I am, hitting character in Mario 64 and everything.
Yep, you were in there with creepy Yoshi.
Yeah.
So what's been going on?
Let's see, what has been going on? It's funny, right after we recorded our last episode, we were talking about how great the aquatic ambience score is for Donkey Kong Country.
Yeah.
And one of my favorite sites, the Hard Times, which is like an Onion type of site. They have a game section called the Hard Drive, or as they call it, the most ethical gaming blog or whatever. but they, right after we like clicked stop on the recording, they post an article called "Man Tasked with Making Score for a Monkey Riding a Swordfish Underwater Creates Transcendent Piece of Music." And it's true. I really like that.
Yeah. Good description.
Well, we got a monkey riding a swordfish. Make some music for it. And somehow you create a masterpiece out of that. Then, you know, gaming-wise, I've been playing a lot of, like, exploring-themed games. I guess because I'm still not really going out and doing anything.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I mean, I'm in a state where this whole, like, COVID problem is actually mostly under control. I mean, we're one of the ones that are doing better overall. It's sort of weird. Like, if you look at, like, an Illinois coronavirus breakout map, it's mostly, like, along the Mississippi River, which is pretty far from Chicago, where the problem is worst. Not that Chicago doesn't have problems, but it's actually not terrible here. But even despite that, I'm still not going out and doing anything. So I think that's why I've been playing like all the Uncharted games and anything else that's themed around like exploration.
How far have you gotten in Uncharted?
I just started part 4.
Oh, wow. So you're really into it. How have you like?
Yeah. So I have been playing them on the easiest setting.
Yeah. But it's like, you know, what you're getting into, you know.
Well, right. I played the first game on sort of a normal setting, and I just, I mean, it's not that I was bad at the combat, but that I really wasn't looking for a shooting and fighting game. I was looking for like an exploring game.
Mm-hmm.
So the other games I just put onto like the easiest setting. So they're really like exploring games. They're not really shooting games. It's kind of cool that you can do that. Like if you want to play, like you can turn up the difficulty and then it's much more of a shooting game than it is an exploration game. So I don't know. It's been 2 weeks and I play like exactly 2 hours of them, like 9 to 11 or 10 to midnight every night.
Mm-hmm.
And the games are 10 hours each. So in 2 weeks, that's like 3 games.
Yeah. Is Uncharted 2 lived up to the hype?
Uncharted 2 I thought was pretty good. Yeah. Mm-hmm. I mean, I like how it kind of switches the stuff it does switching between time periods.
Mm-hmm.
3 was kind of started off pretty strong and then got really, really insane. So it's kind of like if you like games where like everything goes wrong, then you would like Uncharted 3.
Yeah, it really does. Like,
it's just over the top.
It's still good.
How much goes wrong? Oh, yeah, it's still good. I mean, I finished it. And the first game, I think, sort of story and setting wise, the first game's still my favorite.
Mm-hmm.
But I don't, I mean, I'm literally like the intro in the fourth game and I'm guessing it's also 10-ish hours long.
I think it's a little longer than the others.
Okay. Well, the installation was certainly longer than the others.
Yeah.
It's like install and then 20, and even though like I don't have the day one edition. It's like, oh, here's 26 gig of updates. You know,
have you played the most recent Tomb Raider series, like Rise of the Tomb Raider, Shadow of the Tomb Raider?
I've never gotten into Tomb Raider.
These aren't Tomb Raider. These are Uncharted games.
Okay.
So, then highly recommended. Highly recommended. I don't even know how they got away with it. They're Uncharted games.
Yeah, well, you can't. I mean, this is the thing with games, right? You can rip off an idea. You know, you can't rip off a specific character, but You can rip off ideas,
mm-hmm.
which obviously we've talked about a lot of games that are idea ripoffs. You know, this is why like the makers of Pac-Man couldn't sue the makers of Mousetrap.
Yeah.
Right. Getting back to to retro games at this point. Yeah. So that's mostly what I've been up to, I guess. How about you?
I took most last week off gaming. I was just busy, mostly chasing kids around and stuff, and obviously work. But in order, you know, we were back at the family cottage for a little bit. And before that, you know, I'm still getting into Final Fantasy VII. Like you, I play for an hour or two every night other than last week. But I set up, in my basement, I set up remote play for PS4. Yeah, I just tried it out quickly with a DualShock remote or controller. It worked great. I'm like, cool, I'll set this up on my Android tablet. I set it up on my Android tablet. I'm like, I'll just bring this controller with me. I'll set it up at the cottage. But I got the PS4 and the Android device linked up, no problem. So finally, the last night, I finally had some quiet time. I'm like, all right, I'll get back into this game finally. And you can connect your DualShock controller to the Android device, but when you load up the PS4 remote software, the software works, it connects to your PS4, but you get an error saying, it doesn't say this device isn't supported. It says you can't use DualShock 4 devices with this version of Android. Like, are you kidding me? I'm not going to use a touchscreen to play Final Fantasy VII Remake.
That would be bad. Yeah. That'd be a very bad experience. So I've attempted the PS4 remote play onto Vita, a thing that Sony swears is completely supported.
Mm-hmm.
And no matter what I did, it gave me an error saying not enough bandwidth to communicate between the devices.
Even when you're like on the same LAN?
On the same LAN, you know, whatever, 50. What's the not fastest? The
Like the G, I think.
G, yeah, whatever. I'm on a network that well exceeds the requirements that they say you need.
Mm-hmm.
And a little bit of Googling found that almost everybody who tries to play PS4 on the Vita has the same problem. And some people were even like connecting the PS4 to their router directly and still were getting the error. So.
Well, it's been working fine in Windows. So, I'll give the listeners an update after I dive into that finally. But should we get into some news here?
Yeah, we should. We should, since it's been a PS4 show so
yes,
far.
Yes.
A thing that we're going to be making fun of later.
Yes.
In this episode, the retro handheld that almost puts a Nintendo 64 in your pocket. So this is the latest cheap device to come out of China, and that's not a knock on China. That's just where these devices happen to come from. That's, you know, a little portable emulation box. I'm guessing this is just an Android device running a bunch of emulators.
Yeah, it's a quad-core ARM 1.3 gigahertz. The reviews say it's pretty okay. It runs most N64 games, but not all. But also it goes on to say that it's fine with like 16-bit and 8-bit stuff, but when you try to do like PSP and stuff like that, it just chokes. So I'm going to go ahead and say buyer beware on this one.
Mm-hmm.
What?
Yeah, and I'm a little bit, I mean, I don't know. I don't know where you order these things from, but...
Probably Alibaba or something like that.
Yeah, I'm nervous about giving my credit card number to a place where I would order this from. It looks like you could actually buy them on Amazon, though.
Yeah.
So
you don't have to buy them with Bitcoin or something?
Yeah, but I've already sold my soul to Amazon, so I guess that's fine.
So it's called, if any listener wants to look this up, obviously you can click in the show notes, but it's called the RK 2020. And yeah, I think I'll pass on that one.
Yeah, I would like a device like this, but I'm not traveling anywhere right now, so what am I going to do?
And also, you have a Switch, you know, you could always get like, you know, some, like the Genesis Classic cart and a few other carts they have, you know, if you want your retro kick while you're on the road until you find something that could do it all. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
On NintendoEverything.com, there's a great article, really short article, about how surprised Sega was when they gave up building consoles, how Nintendo just embraced them. And it really goes to say when the CCO from Sega visited Nintendo, every single person at Nintendo said, "We love Sega. We're excited, yada, yada, yada." He said, like, the entire company was just unified. And that's when he really learned that was Sega's problem at that time, is there was no unity. I mean, we all know that between Sega of Japan and Sega of America, but I think even within Sega of Japan, it wasn't unified. So,
well, right. I mean, they had, you know, if you listen to Console Wars, right, they talk about that, how Sega, you know, the U.S. and Japanese divisions, I mean, they were creating, like, competing hardware platforms.
Yeah, I mean, crazy.
Right, and yeah, I mean, Nintendo is really a top-down company. And I think you have pretty clear direction there.
I mean, could you imagine, like, as a software developer, could you imagine, you know, your boss saying, like, all right, there's two teams of programmers. You're going to be doing the same thing. May the best team win.
You know? Well, yes, I can imagine that, but I won't go into
a long
story. I'd say if you work at a really large software company, that's not really shocking to hear.
What do we got next here?
Let's see. Open source Master System Game Gear Converter. This title really got me excited because I thought this was like code that I thought this was a code project, but it's an open source layout to create a physical adapter, which is also super cool. I was like, ooh, we can some kind of, I thought this was like a cross compiler, but no, it's to create your own Master Gear Converter, a thing that if you try and buy on eBay, I'm sure is really expensive.
Yeah, and you know, this is for the 3D printed design case and PCB layout. So, I mean, there are companies where you can just send this stuff to, and they'll print this stuff out for you and send it to you. So you don't have to be, you know, an electrician or whatever to do this. But we should mention this is on RetroRGB.com, one of our favorite websites we'll be talking about a lot later.
Yeah, and the cheapest Game Gear converter you can get, Game Gear Master System converter on eBay right now, they're asking $70 for that.
It's not very cheap.
That is not. No, I have, what was it? I have at least one sort of weird adapter thing. I got to look this up. That also goes for some insane amount of money on eBay. And I'm like, it's not even very good. So yeah, that's printing your own seems like a good idea right now.
Yeah, and it'll probably be better quality too. I have a link to a YouTube video here. This is a trailer for a documentary called From Bedrooms to Billions, The PlayStation Revolution. And this trailer looks really fun. It goes from how PlayStation started to pretty much present day. It definitely gets into PS4 and PSVR. And a lot of interviews with everyone that, you know, helped create all those devices. You know, specifically Mark Cerny, or is it Cerny or Kearney? I never know. I've never heard it pronounced out loud, huh?
I do not know.
Oh. But every time I see a picture or video of him, I immediately think it's Dana Carvey. I don't know if anyone else does.
He does look like a young Dana Carvey. But Dana Carvey's probably 60 now, so.
Yeah. But he's a very impressive, Mark, not Dana, well, Dana too, but very impressive individual. And I think this comes out in about a month, I want to say. On pretty much all your video on demand stations. So I look forward to giving you all my review, because I'm definitely going to watch that when it comes out. I think this next one is yours.
Maybe. Oh yeah, this is just a tutorial that I thought was kind of interesting. It comes from vintageisthenewold.com. That's one big continuous word. And it is just an article called Creating a TRS-80 color computer fighting game in BASIC, and they call it a commercial quality game, meaning you're going to build an actual decent fighting game in BASIC.
That's really,
it won't
cool.
Look as good as Street Fighter, but kind of a neat little article.
Yeah, absolutely. I love that they have images of Yi-R Kung Fu and Karateka in here.
Yep, and they also talk about, like, they also give some emulator recommendations in here, too, if you haven't played around with the TRS-80 color computer. We got a bunch of Doom news for some reason.
On PCGamer.com, source code for the SNES version of Doom has been released. It's on GitHub. That's pretty wild.
Yeah, release, leaked. I don't know what the difference is, but I'm glad it's out there.
Yeah, yeah. I forget, was this one Rebecca Heinemann?
No, it was not. So I heard an interview with the developer who worked on this. It was someone who was, I don't remember the name, possibly the person that put the repository out. It was someone who was basically a whiz with the Super FX chip.
Oh, yeah, yeah. Well, I just clicked on this GitHub, and I'm only the 72nd person that has starred this. That's kind of shocking.
Yeah, so it's the same person who also wrote Dragon's Lair for the Amiga, which was like a massive technical achievement.
Yeah, that's like witchcraft.
Yeah. Yeah, if you ever play, that's a really good version of Dragon's Lair.
Yeah. Super Mario Brothers 5, The Missing Stages. So
no, hold on. I'm going to cut you off because we have like, I just rearranged the notes because we had like 3 Doom articles in a row.
Okay, sorry. Go on.
No, it's all right. I think you posted this one. 12 years to spawn a demon in Doom 2 thanks to a programming quirk.
Yeah. So, usually it only takes a few seconds, but the way demon spawning works is it's an invisible cube that flies around and eventually lands and there spawns a demon. Well, if you happen to be on that spot where it wanted to spawn, which would be very difficult, you know, this would be a very random thing to happen, but it causes an event in the code where it would take 11.6 years before the cube to finally spawn into a demon. That's amazing.
That is. And it's due to integer. It has to reach some max int value, which takes 12 years.
Oh.
Let's see. You can now boot a Windows 95 PC inside Minecraft and play Doom on it. So this is about people who have gotten VirtualBox to run inside of Minecraft, which I guess means you could theoretically run like Next Step inside of Minecraft.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, they installed VirtualBox, installed Windows 95 and Minecraft.
Yep, and just have it boot straight into Doom, and then have your, I guess you're using mouse controls with Doom.
I don't know.
It doesn't look very fun, but. It is certainly a thing that someone did.
Yeah. Yes. All right. What is next?
What was next? Yeah, sorry. I was rearranging the notes. We have a hacker segment. By the way, speaking of hackers, when I found out like the guy that hacked all the celebrities on Twitter was a 17-year-old, I immediately gave my 17-year-old grief about being an underachiever.
And this first hacker news, hackers discover a native PS1 emulator for the PS4. So apparently the PS4 has a PS1 emulator specifically to play Medieval. But if you explore the files, you can extract it. And they got a bunch of other just random PS1 games emulated in the PS4. I'm using air quotes, natively.
So why does it play Medieval? Was there some reason for that?
I think...
like, why was it designed for that game specifically?
I think that's how they ported Medieval to PS4.
Oh, okay.
So, I mean, this is pretty timely also because it wasn't announced for the PS5, but it was alluded to that the backwards compatibility that's before PS4 on PS5, so playing PS1 through 3 games on PS5, is going to be strictly through the internet. You're not going to be able to play. You're not going to be able to put a PS3 disc in there and play it, which I think is kind of a kind of a downer.
I never expected to be able to do that. Now, of course, big news was the massive Nintendo leak, which is always like last time we had one of these. I threw a little bit of warning that's, you know, be very cautious if you download this stuff, because sometimes hackers will hide other things in these big leaks. Mm-hmm. And you certainly should not, if you're ever planning to build a Nintendo 64 or Super Nintendo game or any other game, you know, console that was part of this leak, don't look at the source code.
You will get sued.
Right. Flat out, do not look at it. It's like, think the ending of Indiana Jones. Like, that's the kind of trouble you can get yourself into using leaked source code.
Yeah. And this is crazy. You know, and it has the full repositories, source code repositories for a DS emulator, Pokemon Diamond Pearl, Game Boy Advance BIOS, Game Boy Color Boot ROM, Famicom, and NES ROMs, Star Fox 2, Zelda Link's Awakening DX, Yoshi's Island, Mario Kart, so many, F-Zero, Link to the Past, a lot of prototypes. Apparently Luigi was going to be in Mario 64, and Yoshi was going to look way different, and...
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, just insane. Yoshi's Island was going to be Super Mario Brothers 5, which, I mean, I guess it still is. They just... just a little bit of different name.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, the fact that they changed the game title is probably not that shocking.
Just insane. And, you know, I've been listening to a few other podcasts about this, and a lot of people don't know how they feel about this, because people are lumping this, you know, like, software piracy, like downloading ROMs, is theft. But this is, like, a whole new level. This is stuff that was never supposed to be seen by the public. This is like looking into someone's personal journal, you know?
Yeah, and if you work on any large software project, right, you have all sorts of weird iterations that weren't ever meant for anyone to see.
Mm-hmm. So, you know, and historians are saying, like, and this is the part I don't agree with, too. Historians are saying, well, where does this all fit in? You know, should we start patching ROMs to certain things? Like, no, absolutely not. Leave everything alone. This is what it is. But a lot of cool stuff in there. Previously unknown Super Mario 64 and enemy found and added to the game. So this is different than the leak.
Mm-hmm.
And what's the name of this enemy again? This is the
he's called Motos.
Yes.
He's a giant bowling ball with claws.
Yeah, and I could see why it was cut. It's not that cool. And King Baba and stuff like that kind of already do what this did, so no big loss there. But still kind of cool that they put that back in there.
And Super Mario Brothers 5, The Missing Stages. This is not part of the source leak. This is a fan ROM hack.
Yes. So I think it was last episode I talked about Super Mario Brothers Starlight, I think it was called, which I gave a glowing review about. This, I think, is by the same people. This is on romhacking.net, and this is not as good. Nothing wrong with it. I don't know how to do this. You know, not putting them down, but compared to the one I reviewed last episode, this one was a bit more glitchy. It was more puzzly, but yeah. Still worth it, you know, checking out a YouTube video or something. And fans released Super Mario 64 3DS port following the PC conversion.
Mm-hmm.
Apparently it runs really good,
the first
too.
Video of it has already been taken down, so I expect.
Yeah. The second video you could still watch because it's just I guess they can't take it down because it's like a video of, it's not direct screen capture, I guess, but it looks pretty good, but I don't know how much better than Mario 64 DS this would be. You know?
Yeah.
And this is not two screens either. It only uses the top screen.
It's only one screen, so it's going to be worse then.
Yeah.
I mean, I don't know. I'm never a big fan of these projects because, I mean, they always get taken down. And I really don't understand why you would invest so much time in something that 100% is going to get taken down.
If you're going to do this, do it for something for Sega. Because instead of suing you, they'll give you a job.
Yes, it's very likely they will.
All right. I think that was all our news. We kind of rearranged some stuff right before, so I think we hit everything.
We did, okay. Yeah. I was just double checking.
Cool. All right. Should we go into the topic?
Yeah.
All right. Well, as you all know, we reference RetroRGB.com a lot in this podcast, and we're lucky enough to do a quick interview with Bob, the founder of RetroRGB.com. And so here you go. All right. We have Bob from RetroRGB here. And if any of our listeners ever pays attention, we reference this site at least once an episode. Bob, welcome.
Thank you very much for having me.
let's just start from the beginning. How did RetroRGB start, and kind of what's the whole premise of the site?
It's funny because RetroRGB started because I wanted to get back into playing old video games. I'd gotten a Wii and I'd gotten the virtual console games. And then I thought, you know, this is neat, but it doesn't feel right without the original controller. So then I hunted down a controller adapter and did like a mini review and just emailed it to my friends. And within about a month, I was like, this isn't good enough. So I got a bunch of old CRTs, figured out the best one, you know, that would fit on a rolling cart, you know, cut down the size of the cart to make it, you know, eye level on my couch, and hooked up a bunch of consoles. And I was like, oh, this is perfect. And then out of nowhere, I was like, you know, I distinctly remember seeing Sonic the Hedgehog in RGB when I was a kid at like an electronics boutique. So I was like, let me look into that. And there was no solid info. There was a bunch of info scattered across forums, and Mike Moffitt had a page, and Chris Covell of good info, but certainly not, not everything that you would ever need. Just kind of their thoughts on stuff. So I started putting this together, and there was so much info, I kind of just kept a Google Doc of it, and I figured, oh, you know, a handful of my friends might be interested in this. And my cousin Scott, you know, we grew up playing video games together, so he was getting really into this. And out of nowhere, he's like, why don't you just make it a website? You've made websites before, like, you know. And I, for whatever reason, it didn't even cross my mind before he said that. I was like, you know, that's great. I'm sure, you know, a couple of people might be into it. And it kind of just exploded from there.
Nice. Yeah, I think it definitely exploded. Now you have YouTube channels. In fact, I was almost late for this recording because I really got into your last supporter Q&A video. I think you just posted.
Thanks. Yeah, I'm always so mixed about those because every time I ask people, I was like, you know, I'm kind of wordy. Do you want me to cut it down? Do you want me to like to keep the answer shorter? And for the Q&As, they're like, no. I mean, if we didn't want to hear you talk, we wouldn't listen to the Q&As. So just do your thing. And for the other stuff, maybe don't talk so freaking much.
Well, what do you think? I mean, you mentioned kind of history and how you got back into retro gaming and stuff like that. But what do you think keeps that passion going? You know, what about retro gaming or like the latency between video converters or wireless controllers or, you know, the best video signal? Like what really keeps you motivated in that, you know, day to day and kind of your passion with it?
Well, I think there's two answers. I think what keeps the scene motivated is the same thing that keeps the scene, any scene motivated of something that's not current, right? And the best examples are music and classic cars, right? Like I love old cars, but I was born way after some of my favorite cars. And same thing with music, you know, some of the songs that I absolutely love, like I don't flip on a playlist and think like, oh, here's a classic song and here's a new song and here's an old song. It's just, here's my favorite songs. And I think it's the same way with video games, and that people of any age might discover a certain style of game or just stumble across one and just love it. And I think that's why the scene itself keeps going. I keep going because I keep meeting more awesome people and there's more cool stuff to talk about. And I think if that ever ends, if there's ever no new products, if it's just stagnant and, you know, just the more it becomes so mainstream that it's just all filled with clone products and crap, I'd probably just step away. But it doesn't look like it's going that way anytime soon. It looks like every time I turn around, when I think there's nothing more you could possibly add to a console, somebody comes out with something else that's pretty amazing.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, the clone products right now, I think we're kind of getting there with the handhelds coming out of China. The ones that all look like Game Boy Advance and stuff like that.
Yeah, those have been around for quite a while. And the fact that they exist don't bother me at all. The fact that major publications don't take 30 seconds to Google what these are. And you go on Gizmodo and Engadget, and especially if the company hires a good marketing department and they have a press release, all of these, you know, blogs make it seem like, oh, you know, here's this great new product. And what it really is just here's the same old emulation crap that if you take the time to tweak would probably be great. But, oh, by the way, you have to get all these games yourself. Like, they all advertise them as being able to play these games, but they don't ever tell you you have to rip the games yourself or steal them. And they're basically making their money off of intellectual property owned by other people. So it's kind of annoying to see some of the blogs. And of course, some of the shillers out there that'll just do a video on anything to get a free device. You know, that bugs the heck out of me. The fact that they exist, you know, whatever. It's another cool platform to develop on.
Yeah, we just kind of went through this. I think just last week there was a round of the kind of media attention that you talked about with the, what was that, bright yellow kind of banana colored device. And they're like, oh, look, you can play Mario 64 on this $30 thing that you get. Yeah.
Yeah.
I'm like, yeah, pretty kind of confident Nintendo doesn't back that project.
Yeah, 100%.
Yeah, and I think one reason why we as a podcast constantly link back to your site, and also I as an individual kind of go to RetroRGB first, is a lot of your, all of your reviews are really numbers driven. You know, what's the latency? And you show it happen in real time, so there's absolutely no question, you know?
Yeah, I'm always pretty hard on people for stuff like that, because if you have a review on something that's your opinion, here's my favorite game and this is why it's my favorite game, there's really no wrong answer to that. And I don't have any problem, even if I 100% disagree with you, I don't ever have a problem or talk badly about that. But when you say, you know, hey, here's a zero lag controller that feels great. Well, how do you know it's zero lag? How did you test it? Well, I didn't feel any lag. Well, what does that mean? Like, so, you know, it's that kind of stuff drives me nuts. And I try so hard. You know, when I first started doing video reviews, actually, when I first started doing written reviews, a lot of times I'd have to say, you know, here's a whole bunch of facts, and then you're gonna have to trust me on this last one, because I don't have the ability to make a video of this yet. And then when I started doing videos, I try to almost never say, you got to just trust me on this one. I try to always have numbers. And whenever I do say that, the rare times I do, people are fairly forgiving, because they know I'm, you know, both myself and my friends are my biggest critics. So I certainly wouldn't say anything unless I was sure of it. Or I would just say, I'm pretty sure and I don't know. So I never have a problem saying that either.
So you pretty much test everything under the sun when it comes to retro gaming. What's your go-to, you know, what's your favorite way to game? You know, is it on real or, you know, and modded hardware, you know, like a NES with an RGB mod? Is it Mister? Is it like the Mini Classics? Is it a RetroPie? You know, what's your go-to?
So my favorite, you know, when I actually have time to play these, my favorite is usually original hardware on an RGB monitor, with some exceptions. I think that the Dreamcast with the DC Digital mod on a flat panel, I think most of the games end up looking like PS3 games. I think they're incredible. And, you know, while there's certainly a few fighting games I might want to play on an RGB monitor, it's usually leaning towards flat panel these days. Although when I fired it up doing that VGA monitor episode, that was pretty cool too, just a, you know, straight up VGA monitor through it. But it's mostly original consoles, original carts when there isn't an enhancement. And then, you know, on RGB monitors. And I say when there isn't an enhancement, because there's a lot of little things out there. Like, I was just talking to Smoke Monster the other day about the Link's Awakening for Game Boy has a whole bunch of little patches for it that somebody just combined into one that just makes a bunch of little improvements to the game. You could skip text that you don't want to sit there, sit through. And even Link to the Past, one of my favorite games, one of the, I think it was QWERTYmoto did the DX version of it where you could turn while you're running, little tiny things that, you know, that are just minor quality improvements. So I mostly, I guess now that I think about it, I do mostly use ROM carts, but original hardware on RGB monitors is kind of the way to go when I do game. But if I had to choose something else, it would be the Mister, because it's just such an amazing platform. You know, I guess I would call it, even though it's a piece of hardware, it's an amazing software platform that people develop for. And the accuracy and the low latency is pretty incredible.
Yeah, I think the Mister is the, it's the thing I don't have. And it's definitely on my list to, I think it'll end all other ways I game in terms of at least console.
Well, there's still a few very major things that they haven't gotten to yet, and they might not be able to based on the platform. Like, you'll never be able to plug your original cartridges into it. And if you do, it's going to be a very interesting way on how they get around some of that. And, you know, the menu system and the interface, it's by nerds for nerds. I'm pretty good friends with one of the developers, and I absolutely tease all the time about that. Like, oh, that's easy. Just open up an X terminal and, you know, enter 15 lines of code to change your resolution. And it's like, you know, there's definitely some room for improvement on some things of it, but it's the platform that it's being built on is important. And it's also cool because the DE10 Nano, the little dev device that you buy that it's based off of, if something else ever comes out that's, you know, I don't want to say better, but easier, provides a different experience, you could just take that and use it for a million other projects. So you certainly, it's like a Raspberry Pi in that effect, where if you build a gaming thing on a Raspberry Pi and decide to use it for something else, there's a million things you could use that Pi for. Way more for the Pi than with the DE10 Nano, but still, you know.
Yeah.
I mean, speaking of which, is there anything that, great segue into a question I actually have written down, is there anything that, you know, has not been invented yet that you keep saying, like, gosh, will someone just build this thing that I could use?
All the time. Yeah. And unfortunately, because I have no filter and because I don't mind bothering my friends, at least weekly, but probably more than that, a friend will get a DM at 3 o'clock in the morning, like, hey, I just woke up. Do you think we could build one of these? So yeah, it's all the time. There's a ton of stuff. A lot of it's already being worked on. Some of it, the groundwork's being laid out, waiting for technology to catch up with the idea. But yeah, there is a lot of stuff out there that, both for consoles and for accessories, that people could still have and work on. And a lot of little simple things where, if you're starting out your collection and you say, okay, I'm going to buy a CRT and a console, you would never need one of these. But suddenly when you have a bunch of stuff, it's like, well, how do I get from there to there? So a lot of small quantity stuff, like things that would never sell 10,000 of, but might sell 1,000. So, you know, developers are a little less likely to jump on those because, I mean, it's fair, right? You're not going to take time away from your day to almost break even, maybe make a little bit of money. But, you know, that's where the open source stuff really comes in handy too, because you get a bunch of people working on it. It's a little bit easier. And usually I end up then buying the prototypes and footing the bill for that. So,
yeah. Hugh, did you have any questions?
No, I've been sitting here thinking about the mystery of Sonic 2, or Sonic the Hedgehog 1 or 2, I forgot which one it was, at Electronics Boutique on an RGB monitor, because I was working in Electronics Boutique around this time, and we had these like old Commodore 64 monitors they sent us that we used for demo systems. And we definitely had the Genesis hooked up for a long time, but I don't think it was through RGB. Not that other locations didn't get an RGB cable.
So I distinctly remember, I remember it. I was in the Trumbull Mall. It was Electronics Boutique downstairs. I walked in and there was a guy that was probably early 20s and I was probably 13-ish, 14 maybe. And I walked in and we were talking about stuff. And he's like, hey, look at that. I bet you've never seen a Genesis on an RGB monitor. And this is, you know, pre-mainstream internet. So I didn't think to ask about any of it. I just thought, well, I have an RGB monitor at home. I have an old like Tandy 1000. I wonder if I could use that. And then I went to Radio Shack and got a book about about how to wire stuff together, but it was completely useless because I wouldn't have been able to get the pin out of the Genesis. I wouldn't have been able to, you know, so I kind of just, while I was a little bit fascinated with it for a while, it just threw it out the back of my mind because I'm like, there's no way I could figure out how to do this and all of the stuff's expensive anyway.
Yeah, like I sort of remember the Genesis looked better on the monitor, but it wasn't like true RGB. But then I think maybe my memory's like totally shot, but when the Atari Jaguar launched and Atari sent us a demo unit, I could swear that had an actual RGB cable that they shipped to the store, because we did have the Jaguar running on that monitor for quite a while. It didn't sell. There's nothing you could possibly do to sell the Jaguar to people.
Was it a SCART cable, or was it a custom cable with like a 9-pin connector on it to plug into the Commodore monitor?
That's kind of what
I was wondering, that I don't remember at all. I never saw the back of it or anything.
See, I think it was a SCART cable. I really do. But you hook it up one day and then you leave it running. And then at some point, someone just takes the system home once it gets discontinued. And then I quit working there. I went back to college around, early 96, right when the Jaguar was being cleared out. So somebody else who was working there ended up taking that demo unit home.
We have a lot of listeners that worked in stores also, so maybe someone will remember the Genesis.
Yeah, it would be hilarious if the guy who worked at that electronics boutique who was listening to this.
Right, but I mean, each store was different. Like we also had monitors that were connected to a VCR, right, and we would play demo tapes from vendors, and then sometimes employees would just go and film like a run through of whatever Genesis game was new or a Super Nintendo game was new. They do like a Secret of Mana playthrough or something, and then put that tape in. It was like, because Twitch didn't exist yet, right? The precursor to Twitch was you had a VCR connected to your Super Nintendo.
Yeah, I was recording everything. I can't remember if the original VHS tapes I had when my cousin and I would record like the endings to video games when we beat them. I don't know. And this is a question for my fellow nerd friends. Was it actually recording those games in 240p? Or was it treating it like 480i, like most everything else in the composite video world? Because when I eventually transferred it over to a computer and uploaded it to YouTube just for fun, maybe 10 years ago or something, those were all treated as 480i, but that's probably because of the video capture device that I used. So,
if anyone would know, it'd be the Hardfork Games guys.
Yeah, that's all I was going to say. When I sent them some, I did save some demo tapes from the store that I sent to them. And they like sent me a very technical explanation of the ripping process. Was completely over my head because I'm not an expert in that area. And they definitely are. That's all I got out of it. So which systems have you not been able to tackle yet? I mean, I've gone through your page, read everything on there, but what's on your list that you still want to try and do a mod for?
Stuff that I would like to add more stuff, like more sections in the website, is definitely the original Xbox. But as far as systems, I haven't really tried. I was always interested in old computers, too. I just didn't have enough knowledge and then the time eventually to get to them. That's why I'm really lucky to have a bunch of people contributing to the site that are experts in a lot of that. Vanessa is kind of my go-to for any kind of old computer stuff nowadays. So I'd like that. There was a bunch of handhelds I'd never even seen before, so I'd kind of like to check those out. And I'm always interested to see what kind of weird mods and stuff you could do and things like that. I've also never seen an SG-1000 in person. I think I maybe have seen one for a second, but I never really got to mess with it. So I'd like to do a guide and do an RGB mod for it or something.
Yeah, I think I've only ever seen them at a convention. I've never ever more than just a few, playing it for a couple seconds.
Yeah, I mean, it's essentially just, a master system that's not quite as good, but whatever.
Yeah, it's got kind of a nice case. I mean, I think that's about it.
It seems like every American retro enthusiast's last system that they always want to try is the MSX. It's the one that we just never, ever get to see here, but we'll always hear about.
Yeah, I mean, I think the whole vintage computer thing is took a totally different path in Europe than in the US. So, I guess it's just a product of being, a product of your environment, but it's all kind of interesting still.
Yeah. Very selfish question I thought about while watching your Q&A. So, someone like me that has, I'm looking at kind of my retro collection now. I have a bunch of non-modded consoles, so composite out, going into, you know, just whatever from Amazon.com, composite to HDMI, and I have a projector. It's the only thing I have down here. And the projector wouldn't recognize the HDMI signal at all until I put the M Classic in front of it, which solved all those problems. For someone like that kind of setup, that's pretty much, you're not really going to mod your stuff, if not, not for a while, for RGB outs. What would your recommendation for like composite to HDMI, like that whole chain? What would your go-to be?
No hesitation, no doubt, RetroTINK product. And really? Throw that thing that you're using in the garbage. No offense, but I've tested those. They have like 5 to 7 frames of lag or something like that, those generic ones. So, but those were cheap too. It's not like you invested a couple $100 in something. That was like a $20 item probably, but.
Yeah. And a few years ago too. What about, I saw you reviewed a, I don't know if you reviewed it, but announced, is it the CoreU?
Yeah, so the CoreU transcoder, all that does is take composite and S-video and turn that into component video. And that's for scenarios like I have an OSSC, I have all of my RGB consoles connected to it, RGB, VGA, and component, but I still have a bunch of composite consoles that I don't have any adapter or any mods on it yet. And that's really what that's for, is to be able to interface it. And also, I think the biggest use, I don't even think the designer realized it when they came up with it, but there's a lot of people with RGB monitors that don't have input cards for composite or S-video. Mm-hmm. So your choice is to spend $100 to $200 on an input card that's eventually going to need a recap, that's eventually going to need some work to it, one more point of failure, or to spend $80 on a device that converts those signals directly to component, which you could already use. So I think that's one of those devices, like I was mentioning before, little devices of convenience where you wouldn't think of it if you were just connecting one thing at a time. But, you know, as soon as you have a bunch of stuff together like this, it starts, you start asking, how could I connect them?
So would you go RetroTINK or would you go the CoreU plus OSSC?
So it depends on how much you enjoy tinkering. If you just want something that works and that looks totally fine, there's no reason to go past the RetroTINK. It's zero lag. It has the fake scan. If you get the Pro, it does the fake scan lines, which depending on your setup might look amazing or it might look meh. You know, I don't like the way it looks on a flat panel, but on a projector or on a VGA monitor, it might actually look amazing. Mm-hmm. It's all preference though. Oops, sorry. It's all preference. It's got the filter for other games if you want that. The OSSC, that's the type of thing where, you know, you can use it in generic mode. But, and a lot of people disagree with me with this, but if you're going to buy it, it's almost like buying a Lamborghini and just like leaving it in first gear, you know, like you could use it in generic mode, but you would really benefit by doing like, at least on S video and up, getting the custom profiles, which are designed by the community. Firebrand X took the time to really tweak them and to get the image presented in the correct aspect ratio, the correct scaling. Or within 90% of the correct aspect ratio, as good as you could reasonably get. And the difference is pretty substantial if you care about sharpness. If you just care about playing your games in a way that doesn't suck, that's a lot of time spent. And there's a lot of setup, too. You got to load your profiles. Every time you have a new console, you have to set phase. And then once it's all set up, that's it. You just fire up the OSSC, set it to Genesis, and then you're done. But there's also multiple resolutions per console. There's a lot of weird things where if you're already deep into the nerdy stuff on this, you don't even think twice about it. You just grab your remote and go. But if you're a beginner, it's like, why do I need to know 5 things to get super sharp pixels out of a PlayStation? And that's why the RetroTINK, there's no, you know, technically it's not as sharp, but there's zero fuss. You just plug everything in.
And most people wouldn't even notice, right?
I actually think most people would notice, just whether they care or not is really the end thing. And most people, I don't think, would care at all, because it's just, you know, it's just, what are you chasing? To be able to play your games and with a good experience, or to be able to see the sharpest pixels possible? And there's nothing wrong with either of those. That's why I love that there's choices.
Yeah. Well, we are a game club as a podcast. Is there any game you would suggest 20 years or older? You know, anything like Odyssey to really respond to PS2 a few times?
nothing that you wouldn't have already talked about. My two favorite games are Link to the Past and Super Metroid. And those are ones that I could play once a year for the rest of my life and never get bored of. They're just, you know, it's just exactly what I want in a video game. A little bit of adventure, a little bit of puzzle solving. You have to think. You don't just blast your way through, but you do get to blast your way through quite a bit of it. It's not like a game that's only exploration. So, yeah, those are definitely mine. And for the newer style games, I loved the Ori games. There's not as much shooting and smashing as I would have liked, but I really enjoyed both of those. I played through both of them.
Mm-hmm. Very cool.
Just last winter, I did a playthrough of both Super Metroid and Link to the Past.
Nice.
Mostly because it's, you know, Chicago and you have a lot of free time in winter. Super Metroid has aged just incredibly well. I mean, it's... I did the whatever Metroid Samus Returns recently, which is pretty good, but something about Super Metroid is still significantly better than Samus Returns, I felt like.
Yeah, the parry controls in Samus Returns where you have to use the shoulder button, but then like you're also playing on a handheld console that's awkwardly weighed because it flips open, so trying to get to the triggers might not. Yeah, there's a lot of things about Samus Returns that I felt took away from it. But if anybody's played AM2R, another Metroid 2 remake, that one, in my opinion, was infinitely better. It's a game that just one person rebuilt from scratch and took the entire game and redid the graphics and the music. The music's incredible in that, too. So that's one where if you really want a good Metroid game that you feel like you haven't played before, even if you've just played through Metroid 2, it's definitely worth playing.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah. Anything you want to, any plugs you want to mention or anything like that?
No, I mean, just, you know, retrorgb.com is the website, and there's the YouTube channel and the weekly podcast that's just kind of keeping everybody in the loop of what's going on, all the new releases in retro gaming and stuff like that. So,
cool. Great. Yeah. We'll link to both those. So, yeah. Thank you so much for being on the show, and thank you so much for keeping a review stuff that we get to talk about on our show.
Yeah, thanks very much for having me on. It's always always fun to talk to fellow retro nerds.
Absolutely. All right, thank you.
Thank you.
Take care. All right.
Well, thank you, Bob, for spending some time with us and letting me ask my personal RGB questions. Kind of took advantage there, but... seriously, anyone who's into retro gaming and wants to make their stuff look better or run better, go to that website, you know, weekly. You know, RetroRGB is fantastic. Should we dive into some game club?
Yeah, let's do that.
Can we do yours first this time?
Sure. Why not? So I did Montezuma's Revenge because I had been playing Uncharted, and a lot of Uncharted is you're exploring a old temple and then falling and dying. And Montezuma's Revenge is a sort of early platformer game. And it was originally created in 1984, and it's on, like, everything. I mean, it's on Atari 2600 even, right?
Mm-hmm.
So it was kind of heavily ported. And yeah, I mean, it's an idea. You're an explorer, very sort of stereotypical, you know, got the big explorer hat and all that stuff. And each screen in Montezuma's Revenge is like kind of a self-contained puzzle, right? Other than, like, sometimes you get a key in one screen that you have to use in another screen. But it's not like a free-flowing. I mean, it's an old game, right? You're not actually, like, seamlessly flowing between screens. Like, you go to one screen... You jump over some snakes, try and avoid pit traps, get the item, move to the next screen, right? And it's really, really hard. I mostly have played... back in the day, I played the Apple II version a lot, and this time around, I played the Master System version, just because I have it. And, you know, I can get 10 or 12 screens maybe into the game most of the time. With save states, I can get a little bit further. Mm-hmm. But there's a lot of rooms that are just based on, like, seems like single frame timing. Like, platforms are going to appear for a second. You have to jump on them all within half a second. And if you're off by even one frame, you're done.
I know that because I couldn't make it past the first screen. I died.
You couldn't make it past the first screen?
The first screen where you have to get that key that's kind of underneath you.
Mm-hmm.
Couldn't do it.
Really?
I just kept, maybe it's because I was emulating and it was off. Maybe I was just having an off day, but I just kept falling to the ground. I would go to the rope. I would go to the platform. And once I got to the moving platform, I couldn't jump far enough to get the key.
That's pretty bad.
Yes. And I was just like, this game might not be for me.
Yeah. I mean, were you drinking or?
No.
Because that would be hard. You do have to have really like split second reflexes for most of the screens.
And I do wonder if it was just my, emulation timing where it's a bit lagged. Because it can't be that bad.
Yeah, this is a game where definitely input lag would be a huge problem.
Is this on any? This has got to be on a bunch of bundles, right?
I don't think so, because it was a Parker Brothers game. Mm. And that stuff has kind of, I don't know, disappeared. Mm-hmm. Like, yeah, I don't know if I've ever seen a Parker Brothers video game collection.
Yeah.
Now, some other stuff was licensed, right? Because they did, Frogger ports and that kind of stuff. And this might be one of the only original games they did. It's hard to say. I don't really recall now. I still think the game's kind of fun. I mean, it's super difficult, right? Mm-hmm. But I think it's one of these games I think influenced a lot of later games. Like, I don't think you get a game like Spelunker without Montezuma's Revenge first.
No.
Yeah. Actually, Spelunker's the one I don't like. I like Montezuma's Revenge. I've never really liked Spelunker mm-hmm. very much. But I mean, they're very, very similar games. It's hard to believe that, the creators of Spelunker did not play a lot of Montezuma's mm-hmm, Revenge. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, I mean, even something like, what's the game I'm trying to think of? Hero for 2600. Yeah. I mean, the way you get through the levels in that almost, owes something to this game as well, But, yeah, I'll have to give it another try when I'm on real hardware, because it just was not working out for me.
Yeah, it is hard. All right, you want to talk about Short Circuit, which is not based on the movie?
No. And there is a Short Circuit movie video game, so Googling for this one is a bit difficult. So this was recommended by Dagan, our previous guest, who did the Apple II GS emulator, and... Yeah, so this is coded by David Schroeder. Apparently, accidentally, a doomsday bomb is going to go off, and you need to shrink down and go through various microchips and disable them and disarm them. And I feel like this has very Lode Runner-like graphics.
Mm-hmm.
It's actually a pretty impressive game for the Apple II. It's definitely a product of its time. It looks like it was coded on the Apple II. But a lot is happening on it, more than expected. This game is deeper than it looks. You know what I mean?
Mm-hmm.
The gameplay isn't too bad. I didn't get too far. I watched a video before trying to play it myself. And you know how that works. It's like watching someone skateboard and thinking you could go out and do a kickflip. You know what I mean? It just looks easy. Mm-hmm. And I was not very good at it, but again, I didn't have time to give it too much time. And it took me a while to get an archive.org floppy running. The first two I tried just didn't work. Well, they worked, but no controls worked. I could press enter and that was about it. Yeah, I would give this a recommendation. I did not complete it. I did not see the ending simply because someday I do want to complete it. Were you able to dive into this one at all?
No, for whatever reason, I can't get this emulator to work in Chrome. Maybe it's a Linux thing. I don't know. But I wasn't able to actually get it running.
What would it do? It just wouldn't start it?
Well, it will start. I've had this problem on other archive.org things where the thing starts, but no keyboard command is recognized.
Mm.
I'm thinking maybe I don't know. Maybe it's one of my 900 JavaScript blockers that I've installed. Like, could be something like that. But I've had this on many Archive.org games that it just flat out won't play.
Yeah. And I was going to try this on an Apple emulator for Windows, but I just didn't have time this week. So that's actually what I'm waiting for, to really get back into this game and try to complete it, because it really did look interesting and the level design was really creative. I want to call it a puzzle game, but it's a lot of timing too. It's almost like a pre-platformer puzzle game, if that makes sense. Shall we move on? Anything else to say?
Yeah. What games do you want to talk about next time?
Well, Bob said A Link to the Past, so that's what I'm going to pick.
We've not done Link to the Past yet, have we?
No. And I was going to pick Super Metroid, except that game I have not gotten into. And I want to wait to... It's just one of those games where at that time, I just didn't get it. You know what I mean? I mean, I understood it. It just got past
me. Yeah. You don't understand why people liked it.
No. I just never owned it. And then, you know...
Well, it's on the Switch, right? Mm-hmm. It's on the Switch collection of Super Nintendo games, I'm sure. And when I played through it last, it was on the Super Nintendo Classic. Which I like because you have the controller.
No, it
feels like a Super
Nintendo. Exactly. I think my point, though, is that I want to spend a lot of time with it because it's so cherished. And when we do games like that that might take a bit of extra time, I'll usually start the game a week in advance than a game club, so I could really try to get as detailed as possible when talking about it, you know. So I'm just going to hold off on that one. I've beaten A Link to the Past a lot. I'm going to give it a go again this week. And what are you going to do?
I'm going to stick with the jungle exploration theme one more week, and I'm going to do Pitfall.
I love this game.
I don't know if it technically invented the platforming genre, but it, for all intents and purposes, invented the platforming genre.
You probably don't remember this, but in your previous podcast, I emailed you guys about Pitfall having amazing audio, and it wasn't until after I hit send and you guys read it that I realized I was talking about Pitfall 2.
Which had music.
Yeah, which I was listening to the podcast. I was like, oh my God, I sound like an idiot.
I mean, the vine swing sound is okay.
Yeah, exactly. But we got a lot of Game Club feedback this week. A lot of good stuff.
Yeah. I'll start with my headphones falling off. email from Majors talking about profiting off 3DO games. He mentioned that he recently sold his Sega CD collection because he is going to switch to the EverDrive Mega Pro. And he started after he found out that he had a few really, I guess, sought after or expensive games. Yeah, when I saw how much, like I'm going to keep my copy of Snatcher, but I saw how much that goes for on eBay, I was like, oh. Could also look at a kid going to college soon, or I could have Snatcher. All right. Comment about everybody had that one friend with an Amiga. And he had, he and his friends had PCs, but he had one friend with the Amiga 500. And that they used to play a lot of demos they got off BBSs, because the Amiga had a modem. The 500, yeah, didn't. You could buy a modem for it. It didn't come with one, if I remember right. At least I remember having a separate modem for it. The new Sega Astro Mini, he's just glad that Golden Axe 2 is getting released. Let's see. Why can't I read today? Okay, told Jim and Earl. He did play along with us a little bit this past week, and like I said, it's a very low-stress game with immature humor. So that's a good pick. I guess we posted a question on something called social media about what series of three or more have you beaten? And he mentions Phantasy Star because he played the first game back on Master System and was really anxious to get the second game onto the Genesis when it was new. And played the third release. Sounds like he didn't like it quite as much. But bought the fourth one. And didn't finish it until recently. Interesting. Yeah. Four is kind of considered, I think most fans consider four to be the best. Two is really tough. I probably mentioned on the show before. It is so hard to go back and play Phantasy Star 2 right now.
They need a remake.
Another series, he mentions Castlevania. Beat the first two on the NES, but never cleared part three because that came out when he already had a Genesis. But when other games of similar style came out, he was brought back in the series and beat it on GBA. There you go. What else here? Would like to hear more PSU talk.
Yeah, for people that don't remember, I bought that 3-in-1 adapter for my Genesis 32X CD. I talked about it a bit too long, probably, but he disagrees.
Yeah, we could talk about it more. You could describe the shape.
I'll start a podcast about gaming PSUs. How about that?
Yeah. Shantae Game Boy Color re-release. Limited Run Games is releasing Shantae on Switch as a physical cart and as a physical cart for Game Boy Color. Yes, I think we did forget to mention that.
Mm-hmm.
Question. If Limited Run Games manufactures less copies of their version for Game Boy Color versus the original 2002 release, does it make it more rare or collectible than the OG one? I always think the original one is always more collectible than any reprint.
But that's still an interesting thing to think about.
Right. Right. Like, Target or whoever has reproduction Star Wars figures that look like stuff from the 1970s. If nobody buys them, maybe they're technically more rare, like as in fewer were sold. But the old 1970s ones are still definitely more desirable for people.
Oh, yeah.
And, sounds like he enjoyed the interview we had last week with Dagan Brock, because he had never really used a GS. He had used it once in seventh grade. He says friends wanted to impress him with a game called Tones in Tone Town.
That's a misspelling. Task Times in Tone Town. It's one of my all-time favorite games.
Oh, okay. I am not familiar with it. And they also had a 7800 in NES that they would all hang out and play. But that the computer seemed like the future compared to the 7800 in the NES. All right, that's the end of me trying to read and not being able to.
Adam writes us, says some very nice things about the podcast. And he recently started playing a JRPG from the 16-bit era. He thinks he will like called Romancing Saga 3. It was originally on the Super Famicom in 95, and now it's remastered and available on Switch, iOS, PC, PS4, Xbox One, Vita. And he hopes to see more JRPGs remastered like this. So I know I went a little faster. So for the listeners, it's called Romancing Saga 3.
Yes. I have not played it. I just want to make sure. Do you have to have played any of the previous ones first? Probably not. Is it like Final Fantasy, like where they're all independent, or you know, is it like some of the Falcom games where if you start with part three, you'll just be confused in who the characters are?
Oh yeah. Yeah.
It looks like it's a standalone game. Yeah, I don't know why I never got into this series. I'm definitely aware of it. Just haven't ever played any of them.
Put it on the list.
Yeah. Looks cool. I mean, at a glance, it looks like something I'd get into. There is an Android version, so if it plays well, I could just keep it on my phone.
Just don't try linking your PS4 controller to it.
I was never going to try that.
Well, Majors and Adam, thank you so much for your email. If anyone else would like to email us about anything retro you have going on, even if it's projects like Bob talked about, you know, making your setup look that much better, play that much better, any games we've talked about, any game suggestions, really anything. We love any emails. Email@retrogameclub.net. That's email@retrogameclub.net. Hit us up on Facebook, facebook.retrogameclub.net, or Twitter @RGCpodcast. And the social media question of the week from Zach was, what series of three or more have you beaten every game of?
All right. there's a lot of duplicate answers, so I'm going to kind of bounce around. A lot of people mentioned Super Mario Brothers and Mega Man. And then there's some debate over what the correct plural of Mega Man is.
That's funny.
Yes. And let's see. Tekken 1 through 7. What's it calling here? Someone asked if Dynasty Warriors counts, because there's nine of them. Or I guess there's nine empires. I don't know Dynasty Warriors. Have you played
I've
that?
Only played the Hyrule one, which I loved.
Okay. Let's see. What else gets a shout out here? Uncharted, which I'm going to be close to finishing, I think. Mass Effect, Kingdom Hearts, Halo, Final Fantasy, Fable, Shenmue. That's also on my list to play this year, is Shenmue 1. I played Shenmue 1, like, literally 20 years ago now. Wait. 19 years ago, I played Shenmue. I know it's a very specific memory. So I think I'll do Shenmue. I'm going to have to do Shenmue 1 all over again, because I don't remember how to play. But I'll probably do 1 and 2, and then decide if 3 is worth it. I've heard kind of mixed reviews on 3.
I heard it was pretty good.
Yeah, I've heard it was okay, I guess. See, Genesis Sonic Games, Rogue Squadron Trilogy, counting Battle for Naboo in there. Genesis Jurassic Park games, I guess there were 3 of those. And also got some positive feedback on Toe Jam and Earl. There you go.
And I want to call out one series in here, Bomberman. Philip said he beat all of Bomberman and Super Bomberman, which is crazy. There are so many Bomberman games. I think there was 30, 32 maybe.
Yeah, because they ported. There's some port of it on every system, right?
It's just insane. I'll say for mine, I'll do... I've beaten every King's Quest, 1 through whatever one came out on PS4. And
okay.
Pretty much all the ones on this list, too.
Yeah, I mean, I have, like, you know, obviously all the East games that were released in America and one or two that weren't. And, I mean, like, the original Phantasy Star, but none of the, like, later Phantasy Star games. So, first four, but nothing after that. And I've not beaten every Final Fantasy game, because I have never really played 12.
Bonk 1 through 3.
I have not played Bonk 3.
I have not played Super Bonk. I guess that would be part of the series, so I can't say that one.
Yeah, and there's, like, Super Bonk 2. And then there's Game Boy Bonk.
Oh, I heard Game Boy Bonk is not good.
I thought it was all right. I think it's all right. Yeah. I mean, it's for Game Boy. Like, you have to kind of take it with a grain of salt. I guess I've beaten every Katamari Damacy game. Oh, no, there's an Xbox 360 one I've played.
I've beaten those.
Yeah. I mean, stuff like Trails in the Sky, that's a 3-part series. Where you definitely cannot play the third part first, or you will be completely lost. So stuff like that. You probably, I mean, I'm sure there's others that I'm not thinking of, because I've played a lot of RPGs.
Well, I think that pretty much wraps things up.
Yeah, it's middle of the day on Saturday. Neither of us been drinking, but neither of us been talking. So I don't know what's up with that. Yeah, so thanks for listening.